for downloading the Missouri Review Sound Booth podcast. We're broadcasting from the University of Missouri campus in Columbia, Missouri, home of the Missouri Review, the quarterly that brings you the best contemporary literature in fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Every week, we'll be featuring a wide range of readings and interviews with writers, editors, and agents. This week on the Missouri Review Sound Booth, Rachel Cochran talks to Ruth Ozeki. Ozeki is a novelist, filmmaker, and Zen Buddhist priest. Her most recent work, A Tale for the Time Being, was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize.
Well, hello, Ruth.
Hello.
I have a few questions for you. How do you think faith informs the structure and content of your work?
Mm-hmm. Well, that was interesting. You know, I'm interested in the word faith. What does that mean to you?
Well, just sort of spirituality. Mm-hmm. And I noticed, especially in A Tale for the Time Being, there is a whole spiritual essence. And I sort of thought that it had an effect on the way you structured your plot and the kinds mm-hmm. of events that would occur in your story.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. That gives me a way of thinking about it. You know, because faith is very, it's an interesting word because it can mean so many different things depending on, you know, the cultural, religious, spiritual tradition, you know, in which it's embedded. So for me, faith is going to mean something very different than it means, say, to, you know, a Roman Catholic or to, you know, a fundamentalist Christian. And, you know, and so when I first heard that question, I was wondering whether it meant faith as, you know, in a religious context. In other words, for me, it would be Buddhism. And if so, what is faith in Buddhism? Because that's kind of an interesting question, too, since it's a non-theistic tradition, religion. You know, what does faith mean? Or whether you meant faith as a writer. And then I started to wonder whether, you know, whether those were in fact different. Perhaps they're the same, you know. And I think the more I think about it, they are the same. Because in Buddhism, faith is very much practice oriented, right? It's a praxis rather than a theology, right? And writing is praxis as well, right? And so, really, I think, in that sense, faith is it's an extremely important part of my, you know, both my, you know, religious, spiritual, you know, practice as well as my writing practice. I see them as being a kind of a continuation of one being a continuation of the other. And in this case, you know, there's certain, you know, and then when I try to relate that to the structure of the book, I can see that there is a kind of you know, that faith does play an enormous part in the structuring of the book. For example, the way that, you know, faith in not knowing, right? The book is very much about not knowing, right? And I think certainly as writers, that's what we practice. You know, our practice is a practice of not knowing, right? There have been, you know, far better writers than me who've talked about this, and I'm thinking about that wonderful poem, Berryman. Do you know that poem?
No.
By Merwin. Okay. And I think the last line is something like, you know, if you need to know, don't write. You know, something like that. You should get if you're going to quote it, you should get the proper quote. But you know, so this idea that you know, that you practice not knowing, that not knowing is something that is hugely important as a spiritual concern, and you know, as human beings, our need is to know constantly, and we get ourselves into all sorts of trouble by trying to know prematurely, but as a writer and also as a spiritual human being, I do, you know, I think that this idea of not knowing is something, is a practice that's fundamental to, you know, to everything that I do. And it's fundamental to the plot of the book. I mean, if you notice in the book, you'll finish the book and you still won't know very much. And it's very interesting to me because I think that in a way it must work, because although people have noticed, you know, that at the end of the book they don't know much more than they did at the beginning, you know, in terms of, you know, sort of plot, plotting elements, nobody seems to mind, because clearly the book is kind of, you know, is conveying some kind of attitude with which to rest in that condition of not knowing, and to be okay with that, right? And that's what people seem to be taking away from it. So in that sense, it was, you know, I certainly was aware of the fact as I was writing the book and plotting it, that we weren't going to know that much more at the end than we would, you know, than we did at the beginning. But at the same time, it was a decision that was very much in keeping with this theme of the book. And then other things too, you know, I mean, I think that in a way, you know, you talk about Buddhist faith, you know, there are certain Buddhist propositions that are central to the book. For example, the impermanence is you know, one of the, is a very, very important Buddhist proposition. And the book is, you know, is entirely about impermanence. You know, everything, you know, all of the themes in the book about time and being are addressing that. Another, though, is the Buddhist proposition of interconnectedness, what is sometimes called dependent co-arising, right? The way that we are not, even though we perceive ourselves and we experience ourselves as being individuals in the world, if you really think about it, we're not, you know, that we're really more of a continuum. We're part of a continuum. We're not independent selves the way we think of ourselves, you know, the way that we experience ourselves. And so, you know, this interconnectedness or dependent co-arising, or Thich Nhat Hanh talks about it as interbeing, right? This is, once again, you know, I think very clearly illustrated in this book, as well as in my previous two books, too, because I think that My Year of Meats and All Over Creation are equally concerned with this notion of interbeing, you know, the way that we influence each other, and that we sort of interpenetrate in ways that are, you know, it's impossible to sort of pull oneself out and call it an independent being, because it's not.
Would you see then some of your elements, especially in A Tale for a Time Being, as being fabulist, like sort of the interference at the end of Ruth into the Now storyline? Would you consider that to be outside of the realm of actual being, or as sort of a writer of faith, is that all wrapped up in this interdependence?
I think it's that's a great question, because the way I was thinking about this as I was writing it, I was thinking that the book could function on several different levels. One is a realist level, and from a realist perspective, then what happens there is fabulous, right? But it could also, you know, there's a level at which the book works on a you know, a quantum level, right? You know, and from a quantum perspective, it's not fabulous at all. It's just simply a description of the way things are.
Of course,
right? It's a, you know, description of entanglement, and so on that level, it's not fabulous at all. It's extremely realistic. And from a Buddhist perspective, I don't think it's fabulous either. It's completely in keeping with a non-linear view of time, right? The fact that the present can interpenetrate and change the past, right? So in that sense, it's not a it's kind of not a problem. But since novels exist on a, novels exist on a linear level, right? That, you know, and they depend on plots that, you know, are linear and move through time, then it would certainly be easy to read that as fabulous.
And I think that that's what I meant in asking about how your personal faith informed the structure of the work, is this non-linearity seems so important to this book.
Yes.
So I really admire that. And I was wondering if you thought that a writer of faith had sort of that kind of responsibility in today's larger literary context.
You know, responsibility is an interesting word, too, because, you know, what are the responsibilities of a writer? I mean, in a way, you know, the anarchist writer in me says, you know, we writers, you know, we have no responsibilities. But then I don't believe that. I think we do have a responsibility, and the responsibility is to, you know, is to, you know, do what we're doing in the most wholehearted way we can, you know, and, you know, you know, not cheating, you know, not, you know, yeah, just, you know, to be wholehearted about our, you know, our endeavors here. And so whatever that means, I mean, of course that can mean, you know, enormously different things to different people. Right. But in, so I wouldn't want to be prescriptive to any writer.
Of course.
Right. So for me, you know, the process of writing is a process of inquiry. You know, I write about things that I don't know about. So it goes back to this idea of not knowing. I, you know, write about things that, you know, that I really want to spend more time, you know, thinking about. So, you know, that's my excuse for, you know, if you're going to spend, you know, 10 years writing a book, you better write about something that, you know, that you don't, that, you know, you don't have all the answers. I mean, you write in order to try to write your way into an answer, right? So in that sense, you know, yes, certainly the responsibility is to inquire wholeheartedly and to, and in this case, so much of the inquiry was Buddhist
mm-hmm.
inquiry that, you know, I very much wanted to try to not just inquire, but also to perform the inquiry on the page somehow,
mm-hmm.
right? So that the, and I think that's part of the, what was fun about this book was that there was a kind of a feeling that I was almost, you know, sort of performing a philosophical inquiry, but using characters to do it. So, I mean, you can either write about these things the way that Heidegger wrote about them, for example,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, the way that Dogen writes about them, or you can do something different, which is what I was trying to do, where you actually have characters who are, you know, through using plot and conventional narratives, you know, and novelistic structures,
mm-hmm.
actually kind of performing these same kinds of philosophical inquiries on the page.
It's almost like Platonic dialogue.
It kind of, yes. Yeah, it is. It is.
Well, you seem to me a very responsible writer. You have critiques on consumer culture
mm-hmm.
and on sort of environmental issues,
mm-hmm.
and in a way that to me almost harkened back to the Victorian social problem
mm-hmm.
novel,
mm-hmm.
or even much, much older than
mm-hmm.
that. So in what ways do social or economic criticism seem to you
mm-hmm.
Important in your writing or a responsibility of your writing personally?
Mm-hmm. I mean, once again, you know, the word criticism implies that you've already made up your mind. And, you know, I don't think that's why, that's never why I write, because I've made up my mind and I want to critique, you know, something, you know, social critique or anything else. Although that might, you know, be what happens, that might be kind of a byproduct of it, but that's not the initial impulse with which I go into these things. It's more that I have some kind of quandary, and very often it's an ethical quandary, because ethics, you know, as human beings, that's what we struggle with, right? So some sort of quandary that is perplexing me and bothering me, kind of like the little, you know, hard pee in the mattress or something, you know, that just, it's kind of keeping you awake at night. And each one of the books, there was something like that, you know, something that was kind of an irritant, you know, that, you know, sort of that triggered the inquiry somehow. And so in the case of the first book, for example, My Year of Meats, it was really, you know, people latch onto the meat issue very quickly, but it was less that. That's not really, that was almost a byproduct. The you know, the thing that was, you know, triggering me was this question of representation, right? And how, as, you know, somebody who works in media, for example, and somebody who works in corporate media, you know, how what are our responsibilities in representing the world? You know, how do we tell the truth? You know, what is the truth? And how do we find it? And how, you know, in a soundbite, you know, do we even attempt to, you know, to do this thing, this kind of truth telling? And this as a documentary filmmaker, which is what I was before I was a writer, you know, what was a real serious concern for me, you know, especially when I would work for, you know, corporations like the Philip Morris Corporation and, you know, and, you know, basically making documentary style programming that were sponsored by, you know, sort of a large tobacco company, you know, and you know, there were certain things that we were required to do in the body of every program that, you know, were kind of embedded advertisements for Philip Morris products, right? And so that's, you know, that's reality brought to you by Philip Morris, right? And so this idea of commercial sponsorship and the responsibility of you know, television, you know, media people, you know, these were the kinds of things that were bothering me. And I had done that kind of work for many years, and it really perplexed me, because, you know, I thought back on it and thought, how could I have done that? You know, I mean, you know, here I was a, you know, tobacco smoker. I was a cigarette smoker, you know, for the first 20 years of my life, actually even longer than that probably. And, you know, and was, you know, tortured by that. And, you know, it was incredibly hard to, you know, to break that habit, to break the cigarette habit, for example. And yet here I am making programs for this company. You know, how could I have done that? So it was really that kind of remorse, I think, that propelled me into writing that first book. And I think that idea of remorse is an interesting one. I mean, I know that a lot of writers have talked about this again, but this idea that you write in order to kind of, you know, you write out of remorse, you write out of some sense of you know, having failed and why did that happen, you know, trying to kind of probe that and understand it better. Mm. So the critique is there, but once again, it's, you know, it's slightly off to the side. It's slightly, you know, a byproduct. Mm-hmm. And the same thing is true for all of her creation, I think. It was, you know, the critique of biotech is there. And the critique of, you know, the way that as a, you know, the way that these new technologies are, you know, are monetized, you know, very, very quickly brought to market, you know, before testing is done. Yes, all of that, you know, those questions get raised. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the, you know, the inquiry in the at the heart of the book was something slightly different.
So it's something, yeah, you sort of discover as you are writing?
Yeah, very much so.
What would you say was the irritant that brought A Tale for the Time Being to life?
That was less a... That book didn't come out of remorse quite as much as the other ones. It grew out of grief. And it was, you know... I started writing it probably in about 2000, at the very end of 2006, I think, beginning of 2007. And I'd lost both my parents in the decade previous. And I was very aware of the fact that we were time beings, that we are time beings, you know, that we have a time limit. And so, you know, having watched both my parents die, and especially my mom, who had died of Alzheimer's, you know, and to watch her kind of slowly drop out of time like that, it was something that really, you know, it was something that interested me. And, you know, and I had, I think a lot of the Buddhist practice that I'd been doing in, you know, during that decade, was, you know, I found extremely helpful. And the, you know, the philosophy that I was reading at the time, I found very, very, you know, very, very helpful. And so it was really kind of an effort to, you know, delve into that a little bit further and to, you know, to try to understand. And once again, as I said before, to sort of perform that on the page. And you can see how, you know, sort of issues come in, you know, into the kind of the larger gyre of the book, as it were, you know. But for example, things like, you know, the great garbage patches, for example, or climate change, or you know, some of these other issues kind of are floating around in there. But there's no one central defining issue like that. Well, bullying, I suppose, would be the issue, wouldn't it be?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The book really grew out of the first decade of the new millennium, right? And I'd been tracking these bullying and suicide stories in Japan since probably the mid-90s, and was very interested in them, and especially in cyberbullying, in the way that, you know, that technology was kind of amplifying the ways, and changing and amplifying the way that we, you know, that we bully. So that was interesting to me. But what really kicked it into gear for me, I think, was... in the time after 9/11, and, you know, if you recall, it was the early years of the Bush administration, and I was living in Canada at the time, and every time Bush would you know, go on television and make another speech. It, you know, I was really struck by his tone of voice and the way that he sounded like a bully, right? He sounded like, you know, a tough boy in the playground, you know, sort of issuing threats in this really belligerent fashion, you know, this, you know, we're going to smoke him out, we're going to hunt him down, we're going to, you know, and there was just something so unpleasant about it and frightening about it. And I, you know, I was very aware of it because, of course, I was in Canada, so all of my Canadian friends were pointing this out to me at every opportunity, you know, and it bothered me, you know, it really bothered me. So I was thinking about bullying, and I was thinking about, you know, the way that we do live in a bully culture, and that children don't learn bullying, you know, they learn it from someplace that surrounds them. And so when you have the president, you know, sort of, you know, speaking in that kind of that tone of voice and with that kind of attitude, and you have, you know, for example, advertisers. I mean, because advertising is a form of bullying too. It's a way of pressuring you into wanting something that you wouldn't think of perhaps wanting on your own, right? So it's, you know, there's so much of it. What goes on in our culture is about coercion and, you know, and bullying. So this was something that was very interesting to me, and I think that's, you know, it was that kind of, you know, that kind of speculation or that kind of, you know, these were the things that were going on in my mind, and so they found their expression in the book.
I like that you brought up sort of the, like, the national and especially US-centric exploration that you undergo in a lot of your novels.
Yeah.
I was wondering, sort of, you have this technological presence. You often comment on technology. You're not one of those authors who's afraid to incorporate technology into your writing.
I think
a lot of writers are wishing the cell phone had never been invented.
Oh, yeah, I know. It makes plotting really difficult, yeah.
But I think your fiction seems to embrace globalization in a way. But I was wondering how a sort of geographically centered, a geographically situated novelist, even one with multiple geographies, should, or how you found you're able to really comment on a transnational or a post-colonial or a globalized context?
Well, I guess most of my books have been based in the U.S., haven't they? Based in the U.S. and then Japan as a sort of secondary place. And, you know, I mean, of course, that is a direct reflection of who I am. I mean, I'm half Japanese, half American. So, you know, it's very personal to me. It's not conceptual. It's a very kind of personal exploration. And to set the stories in Japan and America it's very much, you know, you can talk about it as a sort of political or geographical exploration, but it's also not. It's also just extremely personal, right?
Well, I'm very interested in the way the internet
sort
of features in, especially Tell for a Time Being. And it makes, I mean, it makes communication easier, but there are also times where communication is impossible and the internet seems to serve almost a magical function at points where things are available and then suddenly unavailable. But it does connect worlds in a way. And it makes questions frustratingly easy to answer normally, which is why there are all these obstacles that Ruth undergoes in the story. But it does close the gap between nation. And have you found that that's a reflection of how you feel technology really is changing the world? Or there are also some you know, cultural boundaries that are unable to be bridged in the novel. So what do you think the role of technology is, even just in your fiction?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because now I'm thinking back in terms of all three books, technology has actually played a really important part, you know. And the technology has changed, but, you know, biotech certainly in the second book, and in the first book, I suppose, you know, sort of slaughterhouse technology as well as faxes, you know, which I think is really interesting because, of course, faxes are now, you know, are finding a second life because, you know, they are, you know, if you You know, if you need to send secure information, you do it by fax now. You don't do it by, you know, electronically. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't do it, you know, through email anymore. And this is something that Assange, you know, Julian Assange certainly knew, which I think is really funny. So I don't know, you know, I think, you know, technology, in this book anyway, you know, technology, it seems to me, is something that we humans devise in order to defeat time, you know, in order to defeat time and space, I suppose, because time and space being the same thing, you know, but that's the function of technology, isn't it? All technology exists in order to defeat time and space. And which addresses, you know, the heart of our conundrum as human beings, which is that we are finite, you know, and that we have a time limit and that we will be gone from space. We will lose our, you know, our corporeal existence. And so, you know, technology exists in a way to kind of overcome death, you know. You could, you know, to overcome mortality. And so I think in that sense, it's you know, thematically very, you know, it's central to our human predicament. And technology is kind of an outgrowth of this human predicament. And yes, it you know, in A Tale for the Time Being, you know, it would make sense then because, you know, technology, you know, and I think there was a part in The Tale for the Time Being where Ruth is kind of mulling over this notion of you know, the stones that were placed along the coast in Japan with writing engraved in it saying, "Do not build your houses below this point." Right. And she is thinking about sort of the durability of writing as a technology and how writing, you know, when it was engraved in stone, had one kind of weight and heft and durability versus, you know, writing that appears as kind of electronic, you know, pixelated bursts on a screen as a completely other kind of, I think, fragility, you know, and ephemerality. And you know, so it certainly does have the ability, you know, I mean, the internet has the ability to connect us in, you know, in various different kinds of ways. But I think we have more faith in it than it perhaps deserves at this point. I don't think it does as good a job as we think it does, you know, and I think we pat ourselves on the back at having developed this very clever, you know, technology, but at the same time, I'm not convinced that it's doing as good a job as it thinks it is, you know. But still, I mean, I congratulate us for having devised it. I think it's you know, it's certainly an interesting step in the evolution of you know, interconnectedness, which is, you know, really what this book is about, you know.
I was very interested in the sort of audience of the book. There are so few books that are, you know, concerned with women's relationships with women. And I, you know, My Year of Meats and then also Tale for the Time Being, two primary female characters and about the sort of interactions between them. So have you found you have a primarily female audience?
It's surprising to me how many men do read my work. I don't think it's primarily female, no. I mean, just in terms of the, you know, email that I get, I think it's probably 50-50, men and women, which is interesting, right? I think probably because of the things that I'm writing about, you know, they're not kitchen dramas, you know. They sort of take on, you know, topics and issues that are not traditionally women's concerns, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think that gives the books a kind of wider range. I have to say, you know, it did occur to me when I was starting to write A Tale for the Time Being. I knew that, you know, that one of the characters was going to be this young 16-year-old Japanese girl. And I really thought that the other character, you know, the character of her reader, should be a man. You know? And I tried long and hard for many years to make that character a man. And at first it was a young man, that didn't work. And then it was like a middle-aged man, and that didn't work. And then it was an old man, and that didn't work. And then I think I did a draft where it was this was fascinating. It was a character who had no gender. It was a genderless character who had no gender and no specific age, even though you kind of had the sense that the character, you know, was in its mid, whatever, middle age thing. The character had no gender, no name, no age. No, there was no geographical location mentioned. It was kind of set in a sort of suspended, it was set in a library, but the library could have been pretty much anywhere, you know. And I wrote the whole thing, a complete draft of this book, without once using a personal pronoun that gave away the gender of the protagonist, wow. Which I thought was quite, you know, it was quite an accomplishment. It wasn't very good. It wasn't a very good book, but it, you know, I did do it. And so that was interesting because it was almost like I kept getting, every time I tried to put a man in place, it got creepy. It turned into something kind of that I didn't want it to be, you know. It turned voyeuristic in a kind of a prurient sort of sexual way, which I just really, I didn't want that. You know, I didn't want that element in there. And so I kept trying to extract it and make it more and more generalized and you know, and finally I just, you know, none of that worked. And then eventually I came around to realizing that, oh, it's because, you know, this character needs to be me, you know, needs to be a sort of fictionalized version of myself. And so once I figured that out, then it was incredibly easy to write. But it took a really long time. I didn't really come to that until about 9 months before I actually finished the book.
Oh.
Yeah.
So did the element of the iNovel only appear after that decision had been made?
The iNovel, well, you know, this was, okay, so to tell the whole story, that in when I first started this in 2006 or 2007, it did occur to me then, perhaps Now's reader is Ruth, right? And you know, and I think part of that was because I'd been thinking about iNovels and, you know, and all of that. And I discarded the idea. I basically decided that it was a bad idea because it just seemed so kind of postmodern and metafictional and, you know, for all the wrong reasons, you know, kind of overly self-conscious. And so I discarded it, and that's when I started to bring in, you know, these other characters. And I did that for, you know, basically from 2007 until 2000 and the beginning of 2011. But I think that the iNovel was kind of there still as a suggestion because, you know, it had been, you know, it had been part of my original thinking, right? And then it was really the earthquake and tsunami in Japan on March 11th, 2011. Oh, wait a minute. Was that 2010? Now I'm getting confused.
It was 2011.
It was 2011. Yes, of course it was. And so that happened. And, you know, suddenly, you know, it was this odd, you know, sort of realization that, you know, that I'd written this book. And the book was very much a pre-earthquake, pre-tsunami book. But, you know, when an event of that magnitude happens, it changes everything. It causes a kind of a rift. And we were now living in a post-earthquake, post-tsunami world. And, you know, the translation just wouldn't, you know, the book couldn't cross that rift without, you know, without somehow making reference to it. It was too real. You know, reality was too real at that moment. And so that's when I realized that, you know, I mean, the question sort of, you know, arose, you know, how, as a fiction writer, do you address reality when reality is that real, you know? And so the answer was to step into the fiction and to make the fiction, you know, to sort of break the container of the fiction and allow reality to sort of interpenetrate. And so that's why I made the decision to, you know, to step into the book and to do that.
What's been the reception in your community?
Oh, up on the island? Generally, people have been very, you know, been very kind and very understanding. And, you know, I think people have really enjoyed it. It's funny because, of course, you know, there's always this, you know, like speculation, you know, people are, you know, really curious to, you know, find out if they're in the book. And, you know, if they are in the book, then that's either good. And if they're not in the book, then that can be good. I mean, there's, you know, it's a mixed bag. I think some people, some people can get very irate that they're not in the book, and some people are very irate that they are in the book, or they think they are anyway. I mean, I think that pretty much all of the characters in the book are, you know, amalgams, as, you know, as fiction is. I mean, that's what fiction, you know, that's what we do as fiction writers, is you know, sort of mix up bits and parts of everybody, mm-hmm. And create characters that way. But people have been very understanding, so.
Good.
Yeah, yeah.
Back to the question of audience.
Yeah.
Now is a young girl.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you say, has that affected sort of the age readership of your audience?
It's a huge spread. I assumed it would be an adult readership. It never occurred to me that it would be anything other. But what I'm surprised at is how young some of the readers are. I have gotten emails and people have told me that, their daughter, who's 12, has just read the book and loved it, you know. And that was surprising to me. I didn't quite think, I mean, you know, teens maybe, but 12 seemed young to me. But, you know, I mean, I also know that YA, you know, literature and certainly what kids are exposed to, you know, these days is quite extreme. So, you know, I mean, I think this is, perhaps it's not as shocking as I think it is. But then I also, you know, what's been really nice is to have, you know, people tell me that, you know, my mother's reading the book and my daughter's reading the book, you know, that kind of multi-generational thing has been really great. I think that, you know, there is a huge, you know, generationally, there's a very, very wide readership, which has been nice. And I think that makes sense. I mean, there's a 104-year-old grandmother in the book, and there's a 16-year-old girl in the book. And so the book, too, is very much about that, isn't it? It's about, you know, sort of intergenerational relationships. So
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's such a curiosity in every character. Mm-hmm. I mean, and now in Ruth especially, to learn more and to sort of be informative and to be informed by things around them. But I think it's incredibly youthful.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
there's something not very surprising if this is a change.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice. That's a nice way of putting it.
You've been listening to the Missouri Review Sound Booth podcast. Music by Mark Catalano. Check out MissouriReview.com for more information about the magazine.